The Beat podcast is brought to you by Nutritia and is designed for healthcare professionals only.
Hello and welcome to the second part of our mini-series of podcasts on the topic of what are the options for uncontrolled seizures when drugs don't work. This series is brought to you by Nutritia Ketogenics, and I'm Sue Wood, specialist dietitian at Matthews Friends Clinics. Today I'm joined by Dr. Shakti Agrawal, and we will be discussing the treatment gap for drug-resistant complex epilepsy. Welcome, Dr. Agrawal. Can I call you Shakti?
Yes, please do.
Okay, that's great. So Dr. Agrawal is consultant paediatric neurologist and clinical lead for one of the UK's largest ketogenic and children's epilepsy surgery services at Birmingham Women's and Children's Hospital. He's also honorary senior lecturer at Birmingham University, and he's also regional head for the paediatric epilepsy training course run by the British Paediatric Neurology Association. So Shakti, you're an extremely busy person, so thank you so much for joining us today and giving us your time. And can we just start really our discussions by describing really what is drug resistant or complex epilepsy?
Okay, so drug resistant epilepsy is defined by International League Against Epilepsy as something that is not responding to two appropriately chosen anti-epileptic drugs given for adequate amount of time. So that is the definition of drug-resistant epilepsy. Now, complex epilepsy is slightly wider than that. Complex epilepsy can be complex because it is drug-resistant, but it could also be complex because children and young people are experiencing adverse effects of treatment for epilepsy, or they are developing comorbidities such as learning difficulties, developmental delay, or autism, behavioral problems. So that also makes it complex. And above all, sometimes the diagnosis of epilepsy itself makes it very complex. So if we look at the story and the history of epilepsy right from the beginning, well before Hippocrates in 400 BC, the epilepsy, when epilepsy was thought to be occurring because of some sort of illness sent by the gods, people would offer sacrifices, seek expiation, and take part in religious acts under the instruction of doctor or priest in those days, probably in a temple. And they used to call it morbus demonicus, something that these demons have caused. So, and then it's only in 400 BC when Hippocrates said that it is no more divine and no more sacred than any other disease, and it is a simple disease of the brain. And that's when it all started. And throughout, I think all epilepsies are complex. They have to be taken very seriously. They have to be diagnosed very seriously, and they have to be treated very seriously with appropriate pathways. Otherwise, even a simple epilepsy can become complex. So it's a wide concept, complex epilepsy. But drug-resistant epilepsy, as I said, defined as epilepsy that is resistant to two drugs appropriately chosen and given for adequate amount of time.
No, that's a really, really, I don't think I've ever had it explained so clearly before, because it really does open it so wide, because it is so wide. And the patients we see are so wide. So that's a fabulous explanation. Thank you. And how prevalent is the drug-resistant and complex epilepsy?
Right. So we can look at it in two ways. We can look at it in terms of absolute numbers, and we can look at it in terms of percentages. So any epilepsy, the research shows that 50% of children and young people, or any individual, even adults, 50% of epilepsies would respond to first drug that is appropriately chosen. And then 11% would respond to second drug, either in combination with the first or by its own. And further 4% would respond to third drug or the combination of the first two drugs. So altogether, about 60 to 65% of epilepsies would respond to drug treatment. About 35% of total epilepsies would remain drug resistant. And these are the epilepsies that need for which we need to explore other non-drug options, which we will talk about. Now, that is the percentage figures. In terms of absolute numbers, I can give you absolute numbers for overall England and particularly West Midlands of our complex epilepsy service. So if you look at the total population of England in 2011 census, the population was 53.1 million, out of which children's population was 12.1 million, which means, according to the prevalence of epilepsy, we should have 6,100 children with newly diagnosed epilepsy every year. So that's the incidence of epilepsy, out of which about 1,600 will have pharmacoresistant or drug-resistant epilepsies per year. So that is 1,600 children who would qualify every year in the country for either ketogenic diet or epilepsy surgery evaluation, or both sometimes, and or VNS. So there are non-drug options which should be available to at least 1,600 children per year in the country, and that is clearly not the case.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, so we were just going to say, you know, what is the treatment pathway for drug-resistant epilepsy? So it's, if you can just reiterate some of those elements.
Right, so I'll just start as to treatment pathway of epilepsy and when it becomes drug-resistant, which direction you go into. So whenever we see a child or young person with funny episodes, first question that is in my mind is whether these episodes are epileptic seizures or not. If you don't answer that question correctly, whatever you do after that would be not right. So once you've answered the question that this is epilepsy, then you think about whether it is focal epilepsy, which means it's coming from one part of the brain, or whether it is generalized epilepsy, which means it's coming from whole of the brain. Now, if it is focal epilepsy, you choose certain types of drugs, specific drugs. And if it is generalized epilepsy, you choose slightly different drugs. And some drugs work for both epilepsies. So then you would start them on treatment, depending on their frequency of seizures, the type of seizures, and have a conversation with the family, weigh risks and benefits of starting treatment, and you start the treatment. And as I said before, 50% of children and young people would respond to first drug if it is appropriately chosen and given in the right amount for the right duration of time. Now, of course, if they don't respond, then you would choose the second drug. So that would be the pathway to go down if the seizures continue. And about 10% would respond to second drug or combination of the two drugs. If it becomes drug resistant, that's when the pathway then differs. And that's where the practices differ as well. Some pediatricians would have, and pediatric neurologists even, would have a low threshold and would follow the guidelines, such as if given by International League Against Epilepsy, which would mean that they would start exploring non-drug options once an individual is resistant to two drugs. And they would then be referring these children and young people to our complex epilepsy service or their regional complex epilepsy service. Once they're referred to us, someone like me or my colleagues would verify the diagnosis of epilepsy, as I said, and then we would offer them, we would make sure that they've been on the right drug, the diagnosis is correct of focal or generalized epilepsy, and then we would talk to them about where we go from there, which would include four different options. I would go through four different options. So first is whether this epilepsy is caused by some sort of structural lesion in the brain, which you can see on the MRI scan, or which is evident from the description of seizures or from their EEG findings, then we would say that epilepsy surgery evaluation would be the right path to go. And that evaluation would include lots of investigations. And then we would conclude whether they're suitable for epilepsy surgery or not. However, that evaluation takes good 6 months to a year because of number of investigations involved. And you don't want to waste precious years in children's lives, which is so crucial for their learning and development. So you would have to explore other options in the meantime or simultaneously. So other options, apart from epilepsy surgery evaluation, is ketogenic diet, or which is, we are one of the biggest ketogenic diet services in the country. And I'm really, really proud of our service. And we have some fantastic results from ketogenic diet. We have presented our 178 ketogenic diet patients who've been on modified ketogenic diet and have seen about 50% of those children and young people with very severe drug-resistant epilepsy showing fantastic effects of more than 50% reduction in their seizures. So ketogenic diet, and it is a reversible option as well. So because you start them on diet, keep them on diet for 3 months, and if it doesn't work, you can always come off the diet with minimum number of side effects. The third option, non-drug option, is neuromodulation, where we use vagal nerve stimulation, which is a device which is implanted in the neck muscle and sends gentle currents to the brain to alter chemical balance in the brain. Now, we do that when epilepsy surgery is not an option and if children are not responding to ketogenic diet. And of course, the fourth option is to choose further drugs, new drugs, or, you know, newer drugs, or change the dosage. And when you are in that territory, you know that the outcome is not going to be very good.
No, that's really good. That's a really good run through the options, and that's quite a clear pathway. So what is this gap in treatment? What is the treatment gap that you're talking about?
Right. I mean, those who know me know that how passionate I am about children and young people to be referred for complex epilepsies to epilepsy service for further evaluation once they prove that they're drug resistant. And I'm always very saddened and disheartened by this treatment gap, which is the number that we expect to be referred to complex epilepsy service versus the actual number that are being referred. So the gap between what we expect for children in terms of numbers to be referred to complex epilepsy service to what we are actually being referred. So the question you might ask me is, how do I know as to how many children should be referred to our service? Now, that is based on a very good scientific paper, which was published in Brain in quite some time ago, in 2009, by Anne Berg, which is a study from Connecticut, where they had, which would be similar sort of population to, and comparable population to the developed world. And based on that Connecticut cohort study, which dealt with diagnosis, investigation, and surgical treatment of children's epilepsy, we have derived those figures which are applicable to our population. And those are the figures that I said to you earlier, that we expect about 1,600 children and young people to be referred to pediatric complex epilepsy services per year in the country for evaluation of non-drug treatments, particularly epilepsy surgery, ketogenic diet, and ketogenic diet. And that is clearly not happening in terms of numbers that we are seeing. So I can talk about our region, for example, so which is East and West Midlands. And I can give you some figures if you want for East and West Midlands and what the treatment gap really is.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to understand really where that, you know, what that gap is, even in just one region. That would be really interesting.
So, for example, so I've got figures starting from 2012 up until 2019. And I have seen increasing number of referrals because of better understanding, some of that to do with our efforts, which I would outline later on in the podcast. And also because of efforts from British Paediatric Neurology Association as well about the to sort of raise awareness of complex epilepsy and about treatment gap. And I've presented, as you know, in many different national forums about treatment gap. In terms of where our region, there are different sort of areas where we get more referrals from, and some are referring as much or nearly as much as they should refer, and some are not referring as much as they should refer. And so overall, we are catching about 60%, 55 to 60%, if you take whole East and West Midlands as a region, of who are being referred to us. So there is a gap of about 40% or thereabouts who are not being referred in a timely manner to complex epilepsy service. And it is that population that we really need to make sure is referred to a complex epilepsy service, and children and young people deserve better sort of evaluation and treatment.
So that sounds to be quite a significant number of cases. So in your experience, why is this treatment gap existing, or, you know, what can be done with this?
So there are many reasons why the treatment gap sort of exists, and we've looked into those, and ultimately I think it boils down to individual clinicians and their perception of what complex epilepsy is, and sometimes I think we have to understand that all epilepsies, as I said, are complex. It is a complex disease, and it should be treated as such. And I think based on that, the most important thing that has happened in the last many years, several years, is pediatric epilepsy training course run by British Pediatric Neurology Association, which has various levels starting at PET 1, and it's, PET stands for Pediatric Epilepsy Training. So PET 1, PET 2 and PET 3 courses, which are designed for trainees, general pediatricians, pediatric neurologists and pediatric epilepsy nurses, and everybody who is interested in it. And all pediatricians, I would encourage, they must do these courses to get a basic understanding of complex epilepsies. And that is one of the biggest initiatives that has helped close the treatment
really improve the situation. No, that sounds a really positive way of achieving that. So in your view, sort of what can be done to actually optimise the outcomes for this vulnerable patient group? So, I suppose beyond education, we've just talked about that. Is there anything further to that, do you think, that can be done?
Yeah, so I think to improve the outcomes, obviously they must be referred to appropriate centre to start off with. And the initiatives that we have taken in our region, and again, I'm very proud to say that they have worked. And of course, it is something that we need to reinforce on biannual or annual basis various meetings. For example, we do CESS roadshows or Children Epilepsy Surgery Service roadshows. So we go to different hospitals, district general hospitals in our region, and sometimes regions which are sort of outside our regions, but they come to the referrals come to us. For example, East Midlands and those areas. So we go to hospitals far and wide and talk to a group of pediatricians, usually on a Friday afternoon. Before COVID, we used to physically go there. But in COVID, during COVID, we've done these meetings on Zoom. And so there's one meeting on 1st of February where four hospitals would participate, and we would present our data, our outcome data, and the referral pathway. So that's one thing that we've done to sort of showcase our service, as well as making people aware as to how wonderful how improved the outcomes are if they get the right assessment and right evaluation and right treatment. Then other thing that we have done is we've made the referral system very easy for pediatricians, because sometimes it's quite tricky for them as to who to refer, where to refer. So we've made a referral portal. It's an electronic referral portal. All they have to do is everybody does a clinic letter in their clinic, outpatient clinic. So they have to just copy and paste that clinic letter on that portal, and just press a button, send, and the referral would come to me in our center or our epilepsy surgery coordinator, and we would log that in and give them an appointment, and they would be enrolled in the pathway. So we made the referral process very easy without any red tape and electronic.
Have. That sounds incredible, actually, and it's very practical and very straightforward, but obviously using technological advances. But that is really making it so much more straightforward, isn't it? So is there, are there any other, I mean, that sounds fabulous, but are there any other things that you've done to try and ease things?
So we've expanded some of our district general hospital clinics, outreach clinics. So the neurologists actually physically go and do clinics there. So we've forged very close working relationships. Not as much as we would like to expand because of workforce issues. Always there is more work than the people. So we would like to expand it further, but we do regular clinics in district general hospitals, other hospitals where neurologists would see the cases with local general pediatricians, and then that would enhance the chances of them being referred and get the treatment that they deserve. So that's one more thing that we've done. And on an annual basis, we do these referral meetings, your team knows, and as many other people know, and which is attended usually by about 100 pediatricians, epilepsy nurses around the region, where we again present our data, reinforce about the pathway, talk about complex epilepsies and the really bad effects complex epilepsies can have on children and families.
Yeah. So really you've set up almost like a continuing education and alertness program to try and refresh and encourage people to see this as being such a crucial element. And so, I mean, do you feel as though those steps have led to much more, you know, a sort of a prompter referral for more of these cases in the region, in your region?
So we have seen an increase, year by year increase, but there are peaks and troughs. So what happens, as is the general, as is with anything else, really, that when we have these meetings, soon after the meetings, we see a surge in the referrals being made.
Okay.
And that lasts for about 3 to 4 months, and then there's usual plateau, or it goes back to its baseline. So we then send our follow-up letters to clinicians who'd attended to ensure that rigor is maintained, that momentum that we generated is maintained, and then you see slight increase again, and then again it plateaus, or sometimes it even goes down, reasons for which are unbeknownst to me, and then the time comes for the next annual meeting. So it's all about reinforcing, making sure that you are on top of it all the time. So we have seen a substantial increase if you take from 2012 to now. The reason I say 2012 is because that's when Children's Epilepsy Surgery Service was streamlined in the country. So from then to now, we have seen a significant increase, but there are fluctuations. And of course, COVID-19 has led to significant drop in, I really feel, really, really feel very saddened by the service that, some of the children and families don't come forward themselves. They are scared of catching COVID, so they don't come to the hospitals. So obviously this is an exceptional year in many, so we can't take this year as a norm. So we have seen a drop in activity of complex epilepsy by about 30%, 30 to 40%, which of course, given that there's already unmet need in that area and already a treatment gap, that difference of 30, 40% makes even more difference, you know, even more worrying, really. So hopefully we will see increase. We have maintained our roadshows through Zoom and, you know, all the video links that we have now come to know. in the pandemic situation. So we have tried our best and we continue to try. And hopefully things will go back to normal once this is all over, hopefully sometime this year.
Yeah, no, that sounds wonderful. So, I mean, are you aware that there are similar, I mean, we've talked specifically about the East Midlands, West Midlands sort of region and the area that your service covers. But are there similar sort of outreach and education and, you know, is there similar programmes going on around the UK generally? Or the area that the British Paediatric Neurology Association sort of reaches? Are there similar programmes?
So BPNN reaches nationally and internationally. So the PET courses are held nationally and internationally. So they are reaching far and wide. And I can say we are reaching far and wide through BPNA for PET training. And that is something that is that catches as much population of doctors as possible. And then there are regional variations. I'm not aware of each and every region as to what their strategies are. But being on the National Board for Children's Epilepsy Surgery Service, I do come across people who are doing similar things to what we are doing to close this treatment gap in their own regions.
Yeah, no, so that's really positive. That is really positive. So so no, I mean, that's been so interesting. And I think it's been so clear the way that you've managed to explain the process and the way things are being moved forward. So let's hope that once we get past this pandemic, then things can be up and running and services will get back, or rather people presenting themselves will get back to normal. So thank you. So yes, all I would like to say then is many thanks to Dr. Shakti Agrawal for joining me today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And we hope you found our discussions of interest. So join me for part 3 of our mini-series when Dr. Anita Devlin, consultant paediatric neurologist at the Great North Children's Hospital in Newcastle, will be discussing the alternative management options for drug-resistant epilepsy. So thanks again also to Nutricia Ketogenics for making this podcast series possible. And may I wish you all the very best and thank you for listening.